I am now joined by two of the very best in the ETF business, Dave Noddick, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database, and Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. And I am trying something new this week, so I do have both Dave and Ben on the line at the same time. This should be a lot of fun. We're going to recap ETFs in 2020 and look ahead to next year. Dave, let me first welcome you back to the podcast. Always a pleasure. How's everything been going for you at ETF Trends and ETF Database?
Things have been great. Things have been great. What a year, though, man. It's been, one for the books, as they say.
Well, we're going to have plenty to discuss. No shortage of topics this week. Let me now bring Ben into the conversation. Ben, a pleasure having you back as well.
Thanks for having me back, Nate. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to be squaring off against Dave. Thanks for experimenting with us.
There's no squaring off here.
Well, look, so we are just going to go off the cuff, and I mentioned this earlier at the top of the show. I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit nervous to see where this heads with the both of you. I feel like this could get pretty wild, but I have no time constraints, no rules, so feel free to jump in whenever. And what I thought we'd do is let's start high level, and then I literally have like 10 topics we can dive into. So 2020 ETF flows, let's start there. We're now at an annual record, right? Still a little over a week to go. And from my perspective, we've seen this movie before after a big market downturn, right? Where ETF flows actually accelerate following a market crisis. They end up being the beneficiaries as the market recovers. Dave, I'll start with you. Just give us your overall impression of ETF flows this year.
I think it's been about what I expected. Every time we have a major market pullback, we see pretty much the same thing. We see a bunch of people run screaming from their underperforming active mutual funds that they're paying too much for. They park all that in a bunch of money market funds, which is exactly what we saw happen. $1 trillion showed up in money market funds and sat there for a long time. And then it slowly bleeds back into the market. When it comes back into ETFs. I think the big story for me is a trend I would call anything but beta. While 70-ish percent of all the assets that came in went into low-cost beta, a big chunk went into non-beta product, whether that's ESG, active management, factor products, thematics, you name it. There was a lot of sectors of the ETF market that pulled in a lot of money that weren't 5 basis point, total market funds.
Ben, obviously, you and your team at Morningstar, I know you track ETF flows meticulously. What stood out to you this year?
Yeah, I mean, Nate, this was a year of records almost across the board, really. You mentioned a moment ago, we're on pace for a record year in terms of net new flows across all ETFs, record flows into active ETFs, record flows into ESG ETFs, record flows into fixed income ETFs, a record number of new launches, a record number of ETFs that are going to be closing their doors in 2020. So by any measure, this is the year for the record books. Some of the more unheralded stories that I think are kind of interesting because the numbers aren't nearly as large as we also saw record flows into muni bond ETFs this year. ETF investors are a tax conscious bunch, and those investing in muni bond ETFs are probably the most tax sensitive of the lot. We also saw record outflows from low volatility products after what was an uninterrupted stretch, a decade-long stretch of net flows into those products. So people falling out of love with those or otherwise rotating out of those into more aggressive factors like value.
Well, I think we can just call it what it is. It's performance chasing, right? I mean, we saw a lot of performance chasing this year. And the negative side of that is running away from underperformers. And low vol and min vol got crushed. There's no other way to put it. In March, they just did not do what everybody expected them to do. While we have some multi-factor funds that actually did quite well this year, the core min vol story has just collapsed. Don't you think, Ben?
I think it varies on a case-by-case basis, Dave. I think what most investors probably were bitten by was just a case of unreasonable expectations. I think many had equated low vol with no vol, whereas low vol is really just less vol, and yeah. Really only in certain
except
cases.
Except when you wanted it to be really less vol, and then it wasn't.
Well, that's exactly right. And in some cases, it was not less vol at all. It was actually incrementally more vol. So if you look at XSLV as an example, in the sell-off in February and March, that fund got absolutely crushed, not just on its own, but relative to just cap-weighted beta within the small cap space. So, there were a handful of nasty surprises in the low vol complex.
Ben, you mentioned the record flows into fixed income ETFs. And I know one of the narratives out there, at least earlier in the year, was that the Fed was a main driver of bond ETF flows. Now, Dave, I think it was you who pointed out that if you look at the actual numbers, Fed purchases were a very small fraction of total bond ETF flows.
Yeah, $8 billion or something like that by the time it was all done. You know, a tiny amount. I think the involvement of the Fed was much more sort of showing the children that the parents were still in the house than anything else. It wasn't so much that the actual act of buying some corporate bond ETFs changed the structure of the market. It changed people's belief about the market, which is that, yes, the Fed would show up at the last minute to be that buyer of last resort or even buyer of first resort should we see major market disconnects, which obviously we did see that in March. But, I think you can't make a cause and effect argument for what the Fed did in the markets, but you can definitely make a signaling argument.
What about the fact that we did have those bond ETF discounts in March, and now we're sitting here in December with record bond ETF flows? Does that surprise either of you?
No, not at all. Bond ETFs did exactly what they're supposed to do on the tin. I understand that, folks from the FT might have written some, upset headlines with a lot of hand-wringing, and some people say headlines, but the reality is ETFs did precisely what they were supposed to do. When the underlying markets locked up, ETFs provided price discovery and traded like water all the way through it.
Ben, anything you would add there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you saw was evidence of the fact that bond ETFs are now part of the mesh of fixed income markets. They're what helps hold bond markets together, and especially in periods of duress like we saw earlier this year. If you just think about the growth that the fixed income ETF complex has experienced during the period following the global financial crisis, if you think about how traditional actors in that market, the fixed income market, have stepped back from their traditional role of providing liquidity, ETFs are stepping in and serving that function. And the category across the board has benefited from a number of different sort of substitution effects, if you will, which have helped drive its growth, along with allocations from advisors and individuals. That just speaks to the beauty, the dynamism of the ETF wrapper. It's all things to all people.
Before we move on here, I haven't looked at ETF flows this week, but I'm assuming you both think we will close at an annual inflow record?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Not even close?
Yeah. I mean, the last week of the year isn't generally when people sell out of everything. It tends to be where people are doing a bunch of reallocations coming into the year, maybe a little bit of tax loss harvesting at the last minute. All those things tend to be good for the last couple of weeks of the year.
Okay, so go ahead.
I would agree with Dave on that, Nate, and I've been surprised. It feels like this year, more so than any that has come before it, the ETF sponsors have been pretty aggressive in marketing, their funds as a destination for those dollars that come out through tax loss harvesting activities. We put a hold on RMDs this year, but incrementally that's going to be the destination for any capital that's put in flight by those activities.
Well, it's amazing. I was visiting with ETF.com Cynthia Murphy earlier, and she used the word acceleration quite a bit. That you look at this year, it's really been an acceleration of a number of trends across the ETF space, which to me is fascinating, because here we are 27, 28 years after the first ETF debuted in the U.S., and we do see this growth still. And I feel like the ETF space feels new and innovative 27 years after SPY launched. It's remarkable. Okay, so let's move on here and get to the ETF story of the year. Now, you may have seen, I ran a Twitter poll on this last week, and the four options I gave were ARK Invest, so just the inflows and the performance of their ETFs, bond ETFs, which we just talked about, right, flows, discounts, the Fed coming in. And then the third option I gave was the rise of the U.S. global JETS ETF, JETS, and I would say really thematic ETFs in general. And then the fourth option was everything that happened with the United States Oil Fund earlier in the year. Now, ARK was the runaway winner in the poll, 66%, which I was a little surprised by that. Not that it won, just the margin it had. But Ben, I'll go to you first. Do you agree with the ARK story? Do you think there was a bigger ETF story this year?
Well, I think that's a big story, but I think the real story, Nate, is all the stories. It's the story of the Fed stepping in and buying bond ETFs. It's the story of the arrival of active non-transparent ETFs, at least the second generation. The story of mutual fund to ETF conversions, of flows coming in through tax loss harvesting, DFA throwing its hat into the ring. I think the story will be, in my mind, ex post will look back at 2020 as being a key tipping point in the movement away from traditional fund formats, mutual funds in particular, and towards ETFs, not just for beta exposure, but for exposure to active managers, for more tactical implements, you name it, across a variety of different types of investors. So a lot of big stories, but I think the big story in hindsight will be that this was a big tipping point for ETFs as a category.
Which fits with that acceleration that I just mentioned. Dave, what about you? What would be your ETF story of 2020?
You can't disagree with Ben. Yeah, this is going to be, we're going to look back and see this is a big year. I think it's hard not to look at the ARK story, right? Because I think it encapsulates a lot of what we've seen coming. We knew that active would eventually show up in this space. We knew that at some point somebody would get a hot hand and be the Peter Lynch for this generation. You know, it sort of happens like a pendulum, like clockwork. We know it's eventually going to happen. This was definitely the year. But I also think this was the year that retail showed up in such a big way. I mean, the numbers for ARK are worth talking about. They've pulled in $18 billion in 1 year in flows. Like, that is it's such an enormous amount for any firm that is not one of the top five. And that sort of puts them on a track to become the top five. And you also have to look at the performance story. I mean, every single one of their flagship funds, all the ones that start with ARK, is up over 100% for the year. I mean, that's just bananas kind of performance. It feels very much like 1999. It's easy to look at that and say, oh my gosh, that means it's a top. But remember, we had a couple of years to go from 1999 before we actually got a top, and it was a catalyst. It wasn't like it just happened by itself.
On the topic of ARK, it's amazing to me because I'm not sure there's a more polarizing figure in investing right now than Cathie Wood. And frankly, I don't get it. So I've said this before. I'm surprised more active managers don't rally around her and say, look, alpha's possible, right? ARK's doing it, and so can we. Instead, it just seems like there's a lot of animosity out there towards Cathie, right? People saying she's lucky. It's the market timing, or she's all marketing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, that's inevitable, right? As soon as somebody is sticking their head up, they're going to get smacked. That's just the neat, whack-a-mole is a game that we play in this industry and have forever. And it doesn't surprise me, right? If it was Warren Buffett's year, people would be talking about him, inevitably falling. I do think there's some legit concerns. If you look at the portfolios, they are multi-cap portfolios. They have small-cap stocks in them. And it's real tough to run, a $10 billion portfolio with high conviction in 30 or 40 names and still be able to have your small cap darling. So I think the bigger question is, how is this going to change what Cathie and her team are doing? Inevitably, they won't be able to do what they're doing. There reaches some size at which some of their holdings become not viable.
So I guess on that, I mean, it probably is fair to question whether ARK's flows and performance are sustainable longer term. Ben, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so Nate, I went back in the time machine into the innards of the Morningstar database and looked back to 1995. So at the beginning of that year, there were 1,788 stock funds in our database. And over the next 5 years, just seven of those 1,788, less than 0.5%, produced returns that were greater than or equal to what we've seen from ARKK over the past 5 years.
Wow.
So already kind of in elite company. Now, if you look, from that point, so the end of 2000 through today, just three of those seven funds have since closed. Two have since underperformed the S&P 500, and two have beat it. So over a 25-year stretch, it's possible to sustain, solid performance, albeit not to the extent that we've seen recently, but at 0.11%, Those are really, really long odds.
What about the situation with Resolute Investment Managers, who they've apparently exercised their option to purchase control of ARK? Could that factor in here at all?
I mean, I think that's largely, even ARK has said that they believe that that'll be settled amicably, right? So, I think, anytime you end up with somebody with this much success, there are going to be a lot of folks that want to participate. And I think that that's what this is. I think it's fundamentally just a question of contracts, and I think it'll all get resolved, and we won't even hear that much more about it.
I mentioned this to Cynthia earlier. Is the biggest risk here just a switch to a value regime where value starts to outperform? Is that the biggest risk to ARK?
I actually think the biggest risk is liquidity. It's
the size of the funds.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think it's reasonable to say if you take like their flagship ARKK, no, the flows into ARKK have not, say, been responsible for the move in Tesla. Obviously, tons of other folks are trading Tesla and bidding it up, and there's a frenzy around that. But when you get much further down the portfolio into, sort of the bottom five names by market cap, it's reasonable to think that the billions of dollars flowing in have helped buoy the prices of some of those more mid-cappy type names. The question is, if we have massive outflows, right? I mean, there's no reason to think that you might not see some of that money be fickle. And if there's a performance downturn, that you could end up with a piling on where people pull some money out, I think the liquidity issues become a little bit real. And so I think there could be a sort of a reflexivity in the performance of some of these funds should flows be as fickle as we've seen some active management flows be in the past.
Well, it's going to be a fascinating story to track, just what happens next year with ARK. I mean, you look at even here recently, the flows into these ARK ETFs, it's unbelievable. And what is it, three or four of the ETFs are going to end up in the top 10 of performance for 2020. Yeah, so,
and that's an important point, Nate, and one before we move on, I think is worth touching on, is that, even just over the past couple of months, so since the beginning of October, nearly a quarter of the current AUM is flowed in. So, a lot of people are at risk of being late to the party here. There are very few investors in this fund that have enjoyed that full five-year run.
All right, let's move on. And I want to tie another story actually into the ARK story, which is one that you mentioned earlier, Ben, the rollout of the first non-transparent ETF wrappers. And I guess the way I'll tie these together is, what about the fact that somebody like Cathie Wood is having so much success with the transparent ETF wrapper? And I think you both know I'm skeptical on the non-transparent structure. And I actually said Cathie might single-handedly kill that structure, because what's the point of it if Cathie is proving you can generate outperformance with transparency? Do either of you have any thoughts, comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, Nate, in my opinion, content is king. So transparent or not, if people want high quality investment content. So I want to watch The Mandalorian. I don't care if it's on Disney Plus or Hulu or Netflix. Like, I want that content. So I think that's an aside in this case, and people are really laser focused on, the recent performance of these funds, which by any measure has been absolutely stellar. So even if it were in a non-transparent format, I think you'd see just as much enthusiasm for these funds as we have seen.
I'll take the other side of that. I think that the marketing folks, and we give Cathie a lot of credit. She's got a great team, and they made a really early commitment to really talking their book. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, meaning explaining why they're in almost every position, showing every trade that they make. It's hard for me not to give them some credit for that. It may not have driven the inflows, but I think it helps keep that money sticky, right? I think, when we've had pullbacks in Tesla, the few that we've had, when we've had some hiccups in the market, that constant drumbeat of information about why they own, what the narratives are, what even what the price targets are, I think that keeps investors in the funds, even when they might get a little bit antsy sometimes.
So what do you view as the future of the non-transparent structure then? We have, five different structures currently on the market? Invesco's out with some today.
I don't think it matters.
Okay.
I think investors have voted with their complete lack of concern. All of these structures are effectively doing what they said on the tin, whether it's, you know, T. Rowe Price has had some success with things like TCHP, their blue chip fund. American Century has obviously had some success with their funds as well. You know, in another year, these 100 million plus launches would have been seen as big successes for a new structure. And in fact, we're sort of barely talking about them because they're all trading at, you know, 10 cent spreads, and they're just doing what they're supposed to do.
All right. Before we move on briefly here, is there maybe a less covered ETF story this year that you both found particularly interesting or compelling? Ben, I'll go back to you on that one first.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the less covered stories is just, you know, what we were seeing in, you know, the so-called smart beta space, the factor space, strategic beta, as we call it, which is just really signs of maturity. You know, it's a product cycle that the industry, you know, participated in with, you know, just as much fervor as they're participating in a variety of different thematics in ESG today. They covered the waterfront. They threw out as many products as they could. And what we've seen is that at the margin now, some of those are being rolled back. Flows have flowed. And as I mentioned before, in the case of low vol funds, actually reversed. So absent, you know, pretty, you know, significant and prolonged turnaround and some of the factors that have been suffering that many of these funds tap into, being small size and value, you know, I think you're looking at a product set that's now going to be pretty mature. And again, I think we've moved on to the next thing and, you know, work from home ETFs and ESG.
Dave, do you have an under the radar story?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a little bit about flows, and we talk about, you know, how much went into equity, how much went into fixed income. I think it's interesting that, you know, a huge percentage, something like 15% of the flows this year, went into total market U.S. funds. That's a new thing. You know, traditionally, when we've seen big flows year, it's big indexes that we already know. It's stuff went into the Russell 2 or went into SPY or all of its competitors. Like, if you actually look at year-to-date flows, VTI, right, Vanguard's total stock market fund, pulled in $32 billion by itself, right? Those are just unbelievably huge numbers. And if you go down the list, you know, it's some of these are ESG funds, some of them are dividend growth funds, but the number of funds that did very well this year, fishing from the entire market, was, I mean, absolutely a record. And I think that's a great story because it shows that most investors are actually using ETFs appropriately for this big, boring, long-term exposure.
All right. Before we get to your 2021 ETF predictions, there is one other story I want to touch on where I know you both have strong opinions. This won't be a surprise to you, and this will probably tie in well as we look ahead to 2021. And that topic is direct indexing. And I actually want to read a passage from Ritholtz's Josh Brown. So he just wrote a blog on this, which you both may have seen. It was titled, "Custom Indexing is the Investing Megatrend of 2021. Now, in it, he said, quote, "If I had a business or a conference or a website with the word ETF in it, I would start thinking about a new name right about now." So as I thought about that, clearly I'm in really big trouble with the businesses I'm associated with.
Yeah, I got some issues.
Yeah, Dave, I mean, you have a couple of websites with the word ETF. Ben, you're obviously heavily involved in the ETF space. So the question I'll pose is custom indexing or direct indexing, is this an ETF business killer? And Dave, I'll go to you on that one first.
I think it's a packaged product competitor, but killer would be excessive. I think what I said on stage last year was, I'm probably going to retire in the ETF industry, but in retirement, my money will probably be in a direct index product. And I sort of stand by that. I think we are at this front end of the, I guess we're going to call it custom indexing now. I think I like that better. Thank you, you know, Pat O'Shaughnessy at OSAM. I think that we are at this really fun part where we get to talk about the innovations and who's going to be where first and when does this trickle down to retail. It is coming, right? Schwab didn't buy Motif and Hardy Boile's team for no reason. They bought it because it blends in perfectly with what they're doing with Schwab Intelligent Portfolios. and their fractional share effort, right? You put all those things together, and sure, there's going to be a mass affluent direct index product coming from Schwab, maybe next year, maybe the year after. But I think before we start singing the death knell for ETFs, we have to recognize most of the products we're talking about in this space are very narrowly limited to U.S. equities, and really many of them to just sort of large and mid-cap U.S. equities, largely because of a data and execution issue. So that leaves a lot of playground to play in for the ETF industry, even if you believed that somehow all the domestic equity in the world was going to get subsumed by custom indexing.
Ben?
Yeah, I think it's a solution, one among many, that meets very specific needs amongst a very specific type of investor. And even in Josh's post and, you know, in conversations I've had with others around the industry, that is oftentimes a tax situation, a situation where somebody comes to an advisor, comes to an asset manager with a concentrated position, say an employer stock, and needs to build around that position to avoid unlocking taxable capital gains. So I think it fits the needs of a lot of investors, particularly, you know, in the high net worth and ultra high net worth space. Like Dave, I think there is a movement afoot to make it more broadly available to the mass affluent. You know, and all of these things I think ultimately will take time. I think it'll sit aside ETFs, and I think needs to be framed in the context of the broader trend, which is just kind of the replatforming of the asset management business at large, away from open-ended mutual funds to ETFs in the individual and then intermediary space, to CITs in the retirement space. This is just, you know, one among, you know, a growing number of options that investors have that is going to probably serve them better than an open-ended mutual fund.
So at the end of the day, what's the biggest value prop of custom indexing?
For me, it's actually single stock exclusion. And if you read some of the Rithold stuff, they sort of get to that point too. It's the ability to create a portfolio that manages around an existing economic exposure. For most high net worth clients, that's a single stock, usually one that they, for a company they work or worked at. You know, that ability to say, here's your large cap fund and it doesn't have any Google in it. It sounds so simple, but for a lot of executives and a lot of high net worth people, that is their number one problem, burning down a large company stock position.
Yeah, as I look at this, I think certainly for high net worth investors, there are some really interesting use cases that I don't think you can really argue with. There's absolutely value to custom indexing. I think for really ESG inclined investors, where they just don't want to own certain companies, this can be a good mousetrap. What I worry about is if you roll this out to the masses, including advisors who don't always exercise the best behavior, is this is just another form of active management that we're taking indexes and tweaking them on the back end. You're ultimately going to get tracking error with that. You don't know how well the tax alpha plays out longer term. We've been in a certain type of market environment over the past 10 years. What does that look like 10 years moving forward? And so I just worry that this is, I guess I'll say active management in sheep's clothing.
It can be, certainly. It certainly doesn't have to be, right? And I think, again, that comes down to the individual discussion between an advisor and an investor. This is not a hands-off product set, right?
Yeah.
Nobody. I think we're a long way before I log into my Schwab account and do this on my own.
All right, so I don't need to rename the podcast Custom Indexing Prime?
Not probably for the next 5 years. You're good for a while.
All right, with our remaining time, let's now get to your 2021 ETF predictions, which, by the way, so both of you were on the podcast late last year, and I asked for your predictions, and I actually went back and listened to those. I would say you both took very different approaches here. And Dave, I'll start with you. So you made a number of predictions, and I thought you did pretty well overall. You said we'd see more industry consolidation. You thought investors would look to position more defensively in 2020, and there'd be more volatility. Of course, little did we know there'd be a pandemic, but nevertheless, good prediction. And you correctly predicted no Bitcoin ETF, which, as you know, is a thorn in my side. Let me play that one.
No Bitcoin ETF approval in 2020 would be my prediction. It's politically unwise. Why would they push this to the top of the agenda in a year when there's going to be so much else going on coming out of Washington? I just don't see it.
All right. So excellent job on that. I was wrong, by the way. I honestly thought we'd see a Bitcoin ETF this year. And then, Ben, look, I've got to say, you didn't exactly go out on a limb here. Let me play your prediction.
I think what you will see with certainty is a continuation of trends that have been in place now for quite some time. So the overwhelming majority of net new money is continuing to go into the very cheapest of the cheap funds, those that are offering the most broad-based, diversified exposures, those that are the most useful to the largest number of end investors. And those funds just so happen to be offered by the top, you know, 3 to 5 providers who continue to own and amass the lion's share of net new money.
All right, Ben, you know I love you. I would say that was a bit of a yawner. So I've decided this year I'm going to try to pin you down a little bit. You get first shot here for 2021. Give us a couple, which, by the way, your prediction was correct, but we'll see if we can get something a little more exciting this year. Give us a couple of predictions for next year.
We can't just play that one again, because I stand by that headed into 2021. No, I mean, all kidding aside, I think you'll see a continuation next year of some trends, you know, that have taken root this year, which is, you know, continued flow into actively managed ETFs. I think you'll see more active non-transparent ETF launches. We saw 4 just today from Invesco. I think you're going to see some more mutual fund to ETF conversions in those circumstances where, you know, it's easy on the part of the asset manager and makes sense on sort of behalf of end investors, you know, in those funds, which, again, is really just a continuation of trends that are already in flight. My hope is that you'll see people get over the fee war, which, you know, I think has become a fee bore. I think investors right now are at risk in trying to pinch a penny or two here or there of being many pounds, you know, foolish, just given that, you know, what matters most now that fees have been squeezed out, you know, and are zero in certain instances is, you know, the process, the index construction, you know, the process adhered to by active managers in the case of active ETFs. That's going to yield a lot more bips over the long term than a bip or two, a penny or two of fee savings, you know, that you can see, you know, right there on the fact sheet. So hopefully investors refocus on process, which is ultimately what matters more so than anything for their long-term outcomes than paying 3 bips versus 4 bips or 2 versus 3.
You mentioned mutual fund to ETF conversions. That's one that I think is going to be really interesting to watch next year. Obviously, DFA has what like 6 mutual funds are going to be converting to ETFs. I saw something this morning in the Financial Times where it was an attorney talking about how they've talked to several large fund companies, and there's going to be some announcements soon about funds converting to, or mutual funds converting to ETFs. That's an interesting story. I mean, that could be a tailwind. Now, obviously, you know, for fund companies, and Ben, maybe you pointed this out on Twitter when I had tweeted something out, that have a large allocation in 401ks, this isn't going to be applicable. But for, you know, for other maybe smaller fund companies, there could be some real assets here.
Yeah, it absolutely could be the case. But there's a lot of resistance there. There's a lot of inertia. There's a lot of hurdles to clear, depending on how many share classes the fund has, depending on where it's been distributed historically. So if it's got more retirement assets than anything else, it's going to be a challenge, because a lot of your clientele are going to be in defined contribution plans. You know, ETFs require brokerage, so it can get really hairy really quickly. There's, I would say, probably a small minority of mutual funds that can do it as cleanly as those that have teed up conversions to date.
All right, Dave, quickly here, what do you have for us? Give us a couple of ETF predictions.
Yeah, I actually don't think it's going to be a giant year in terms of sort of earth-shattering regulatory changes, et cetera. I think we're going to see a lot more focus on ETF's tax advantage in both a pro and a con way. You know, the discussions around things like heartbeat trading obviously became a bit of an issue from folks who didn't understand much about how creation redemption works around the Tesla inclusion in the S&P 500. I am a little concerned that that's going to continue to be a narrative. It requires a lot of explanation for people to understand that you're not just ditching taxes, you're just engaging in a kind of what I would consider tax fairness, tax deferral in ETFs. But I think that that's on the table for discussion, which makes me a little bit nervous. I think more importantly, I think it's going to be another banner year for ETF flows. I think we're going to see continuations of the core themes we're seeing this year, whether it's active management, ESG, et cetera. I still don't think we're going to see a Bitcoin ETF this year. And I think we're going to see a lot of products focused on risk management, whether those are new defined outcome products. Pacer just announced a whole bunch of those today or yesterday. I think we're going to see a lot of folks talking about risk management because we've just been through a bit of a ringer on that.
Well, Dave, Ben, just an absolute blast this week. I really appreciate the time. Happy holidays to you and your family, and look forward to connecting again in the new year. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nate.
That was ETF Trends and ETF Databases' Dave Nodig and Morningstar's Ben Johnson.